So this is the second class on Britain since 1945. I'm going to continue from the 1945 elections, which I began to speak about last week, and in particular this what can seem from a distance rather a surprising result, in that the war hero, Winston Churchill, was decisively defeated. A Labour landslide came through. The Labour Party won 393 seats. In the last elections, they had 154. So they more than doubled their seats, and the Conservatives more than halved their seats. So absolute massive victory. And in Labour Party mythology, I don't mean that they made it up, but in the Labour Party image of themselves, 1945 is the golden year. It's the moment. Just like in France, 1936 is the proud moment of the left, with the first paid holidays, etc. And 1968 for the new left. Well, 1945 is the Labour election, is the Labour thing. Now, the Communist Party won two seats. This is very important because Britain is different from France, Spain and Italy, in that the Communist Party was never a mass party. In France, I think in 1945, the Communist Party had 5 million votes or more. It was enormous. Yeah? I mean, it was a minority party, but it was a very, very big force. Yeah. And of course, you had the Banlieue Rouge, a whole series of towns around Paris controlled by the Communist Party. There are still a few. But the Communist Party was very, very important, of course, because in France, the Communist Party was, in their documents, they said, Le Parti des 100,000 Fusillés. And it was true. It was true. The Communists were at the centre of the resistance and got a lot of people killed. So afterwards, your people wanted to vote for the Communists also for that reason. Of course, in Britain, we didn't have invasion. We didn't have that kind of resistance, so that wasn't the case. But also, the election system in Britain helps the big parties, as you know. And so, for example, in 1945, the Liberals got 12 seats. Yeah, like you say, the Communists, 2 seats. So nothing is happening. The two big parties, in electoral terms, in parliamentary terms, two big parties. Why? Well, this is partly because of the electoral system. That is to say, that there is only one round. In France, you have two rounds, yes? Two Sundays. In Britain, we have one round on a Thursday. Always on a Thursday. Why Thursday? Well, firstly, I think the idea was it was impossible to get people out of the house on a Sunday. When it rains, and it rains all the time, and we stay at home, you know. Otherwise, I don't know why Thursday, but Thursday was always payday. For many, many decades, people were paid every week in cash, and they were paid on a Thursday. So maybe maybe the government thought, let's have the election on payday. Because as you know, when the population is happy with their lives, they vote more for the government. That's a general sort of rule. So I don't know exactly why. But certainly, the main thing is there's only one round. And if you have North Manchester, in theory, you could have 25 candidates, and the candidate with the most votes has won. Yeah? So if you have one candidate with 9%, 9%, 9%, 9%, 9%, 10%, 9%, 9%, the candidate with 10% has won, and that's the end of the story. In reality, this doesn't happen because there are just two big parties. Yeah, so in reality, it doesn't happen. But in theory, it could happen. For the legislative elections, for the parliamentary elections, this has never changed. In a few months' time, in May in Britain today, in May 2015, there are elections in Britain, and this is still going to be the same system. Yeah, this is on dit en français, le scrutin majoritaire à un seul tour. And in English we say the first past the post system, le premier qui franchit la ligne d'arrivée. In reality, it is not as undemocratic as it sounds, because there are not 10 candidates in the two big parties work. But it means that if you're a small party, it's very, very difficult. Because let's imagine you're a small party and you have 10% support in every town in the country. In this way, you will have zero members of parliament. Let's imagine you have 20% support in every town in the country. Zero members of parliament. because you have to get more than half the votes in one town to get to one member of parliament. Yeah. The result is that small groups on the left, generally generally for a long time, joined the Labour Party, and small groups on the right joined the Conservative Party, because building a small party, you're not going to get any members of parliament. Yeah, so it really does change the situation. It's a little different today. The Green Party today, I think they have one member of parliament, maybe two. But then again, remember that some radical parties are not really, their priority is not to have members of parliament. Their priority might be to support strikes, to organise demonstrations, petitions, meetings, etc. Because more radical groups tend to think that parliament is not the place where the world changes. But in Parliament, that's what happened. And I've stopped for so long on that my iPad has gone to sleep. Right, okay. Now, in fact, in terms of the percentage of votes cast, Labour's victory was less overwhelming. The Labour Party got 48% of the vote, and the Conservatives 39% of the vote. Sections of the elites really were... quite panicking. Clement Attlee became the new Prime Minister. There he is, Clement Attlee. And there was certainly a big change in style. So normally the palace, Buckingham Palace, sends a limousine to get the new Prime Minister to come to ask the Queen to form a government, because formally the new Prime Minister asks the Queen if he can form a government. She always says yes. But Clement Attlee said, no, I don't need a limousine. And he drove his own little car to the palace to see the king, not the queen, the king. So it was the change of style was very, very important. In the new Labour government, of the 37 ministers, 8 of them were minors. 8 des ministres, c'est des mineurs de fond. So you can see it's another style, yes? Now, even today, the British government is made of ministers who generally went to private schools. But you can imagine, in 1945, 8 minors in government. It was absolutely incredible situation. In the parliament, they sang the red flag, le drapeau rouge. The members of parliament sang the red flag. The people's flag is deepest red. It shrouded oft our martyred dead. And ere their limbs grew stiff and cold, their life's blood dyed its every fold, etc. I'm not going to sing. I'll put it on the web. It'll rain. And so there was a tremendous... on the one hand, the population was hoping that there would be big changes. Of course, the population were not revolutionaries. Most people aren't. But they wanted real changes. They wanted to see much more help for the unemployed, much less unemployed, much better housing. A lot of housing had been destroyed in the war, but even the housing which was not destroyed, it was pretty bad. You saw the countryside in the video, which was better, but even so, you didn't have a bathroom inside. You didn't have hot, you had to heat the water. That was very normal. Certainly my grandmother still had an outside toilet in 1980. Now, this was minority at the time, in 1980, yeah? But certainly, it's an important element. The 1950s is the moment when the majority of the British get inside toilets. Now, it sounds like a detail. Try it. It's not that much fun. So, what did Labour Party do then? Once they were... Oh, sorry, I want to present two of the other gentlemen. Clement Attlee, then Prime Minister. We often exaggerate the role of the Prime Minister. We act as if the Prime Minister can do anything they want. So this is just for shorthand. So we often say, Margaret Thatcher did this and this and this. Now, even when you're Prime Minister, you can't do everything you want. It's always a team. But just to make it easier, we talk about the individual. So Clement Attlee was the Prime Minister. Aneurin Bevan, the last guy, Aneurin Bevan, a Welshman, Aneurin. That's a Welsh name, was the minister of... What was he minister of? Jesus, I've forgotten what he was minister of. In any case, he was Minister of Health. And he is one of the great heroes of the left wing in Britain, because he established the National Health Service. And I don't want to say too much about that, because the video you're going to watch is about that. But even today... When you go to see a doctor, you don't pay. I had an experience with this 2 years ago when I was in London. I was in London in winter, and I was running for a bus and trying to get my travel card at the same time. And I went over and really was blood everywhere. And I hit my head directly on the pavement without my arms. And somebody called an ambulance. So they took me to the hospital, and they x-rayed, and they gave me some painkillers and so on. And then I went home. Nobody asked my name. Yeah. Nobody asked for my social security number. Nobody asked for my credit card. They just helped me. Yeah. And so this is still, I have to say that this is still, pour une fois que les anglais font les choses mieux que les français, je tiens à souligner. It's true that even today, there's definitely this atmosphere. Now it's interesting because in theory, and they gave me some medicine, and in theory I was supposed to pay for the medicine. I knew that this was the rules, that the treatment was free, but I should pay for the medicine. And so I did pay, but I had to insist. I'd say, where do I go to pay? And they'd say, oh, well, somewhere. And because the nurses and doctors, the rules were patients must pay. But in fact, the nurses and doctors were not interested in making you pay. I paid because it seemed to me to be reasonable to pay. Yeah. But I had to really insist. And the guy, hey, where can he pay? Oh, I don't know. Ask Michael. You know, it was really bizarre. There are many problems with the health service, like every health service. But it's true that this free element is something that the English are very proud of. Okay. So what did the Labour Party do? One of the first things they did is they followed a lot of the ideas from the New Fabian Research Bureau. So nationalisation, a lot of nationalisation. First of all, the Bank of England, la Banque d'Angleterre, the National Bank, was now controlled by the government. They nationalised civil aviation, the aeroplanes. Now, of course, the aeroplane industry was much smaller in 1945 than today. There was no EasyJet and so on, but that was nationalised. Coal, they nationalised the coal. The coal industry was nationalised. Coal was still an enormous, I don't know how many miners there were, probably at least 500,000 miners. At least 500,000 miners. Oil is not very important, la pétrole n'est pas important, à cette époque, for England. They nationalised in 1947 the railways. They nationalised in 1947 the electricity, 1948 the gas, 1949 iron and steel. So the biggest industries in the country were nationalised. Why was this? In the ideas of the time, which are not quite so common today, the idea of if you have a nationalised industry, it does not have to act only for profits. It can also act for two other things. This is the theory. Afterwards, everybody has their opinion. It can also act, one, in the national interest, make choices for the population's interest, and secondly, in the interest of the people who work there. So the theory was that the nationalised industry will not always try to reduce wages, because it will try, on the contrary, to give the example to the rest of the companies as how to treat your workers well. This was partly true. It was not completely true, but it's true that in the 50s and 60s, if you worked in a nationalised industry, you were treated better. You wouldn't lose your job so easily, and so on. And this was a pressure on private companies to not make profit their only priority. However, this in the Labour Party and in the Labour movement and the Labour government was a big debate. I realise I talk rather fast, so it's good that I record it so you can have another chance. Yeah. Am I talking a bit too fast? Put your hand up if you think I'm talking too fast. Okay, I'll slow down. Yeah, that's half the class. Yeah, I can slow down. It's a coffee. Yeah. Okay, so why? I don't want to slow down too much, because you mustn't learn slow English, because slow English doesn't exist. And if you speak like this, everybody will understand, but mais quelqu'un va se mettre le point dans votre gueule vite fait, parce que c'est insupportable. Okay, so why nationalize? This was a debate, why nationalize? And there were inside the labor industry, there were two completely different views. On the left, saying, yeah, we are nationalizing these industries as the first step to abolishing capitalism. Capitalism doesn't work. Deciding everything by profit doesn't work. So we start by the big industries, but the idea is that little by little we will make private profits not so important, and the public interest will be at the center of the economy. Inside the Labour Party, there was a second view, completely different. No. We are nationalising the big industries to make British capitalism more efficient, to make British capitalism better at competing with the world, so that our economy will work better than the economies of the other countries. So they agree on nationalising, but they're not nationalising for the same reason. The Labour election manifesto used the second argument. If a private industry serves the nation, said the manifesto, well and good. If it is inefficient, then we should nationalise it. So you have this decision. Second question, how do you nationalise? So you have a big, for example, you have in 1945, you have a big private coal industry belonging to private companies. Two different ideas. On the left, we nationalize because this coal industry was built by ordinary workers and it belongs to us, and so we nationalized. We don't buy the industry from the owners, we just nationalize it because it's really ours. The people who made the profit did not do the work. The workers did the work, so we'll nationalize it. Inside the Labour Party, a second position, no. We must compensate the owners. We must pay the present owners and buy the industry from their private owners. And the second one was the case. There was compensation. And thirdly, when you have nationalised an industry, how does it work inside? Two different positions in the Labour Party. I'm talking about the debate in the Labour Party. On the left, well, nationalised industries should be completely different from private industries. We want them to be democratically controlled. The workers, the ordinary workers, must participate in the decisions made for the gas industry, for the coal industry, and so on. Workers' control. And on the left, no. We nationalise because it's more efficient, but generally management techniques should continue in the same way. And the result was, in fact, a compromise. There was much more consulting of the workers. The trade unions had a more important role in the nationalised industries and so on. Housing and... Je suis pas sûr exactement où je suis là sur cette liste. The welfare state. Let's go for the welfare state. The welfare state and the National Health Service, the NHS, the National Health Service. Now, of course, the welfare state, l'état-providence, we talk about it a lot in history, but we need to be a little bit more precise about what it means, because it's a very, very big idea, and fundamentally it says that the state, the government, has much more responsibility than previously. Perhaps you remember in the 19th century, when there were terrible problems of epidemics, cholera, typhoid, the government said, well, that's terrible, but it's not a government problem. Now, there was the general case in the 19th century was that people's health was not considered to be a government problem. People's health is a problem to be solved by individuals, by charities, by religions, but not for the government. It's not a government problem. And very slowly, the responsibilities of government have risen, and from 1945, the welfare state was the idea that if people suffer, it's always a government problem. And I mentioned last week the phrase of Beveridge, from cradle to grave. The government or the state is responsible for its citizens from cradle to grave. So if too many children die, if a lot of children are dying, it's a government problem. Whereas previously it was not considered. Now that makes it very wide. So the welfare state includes money for unemployed people, free health, building new housing, the government building housing. Previously, government building housing began in the 1920s, but very small. In the 40s and 50s and 60s, millions of houses were built by the government. Millions. Because they said, housing is so bad, we cannot leave this to private enterprise. It will not be efficient. And probably housing is the biggest. The National Health Service was established in 1948, free. And I mentioned that British people are very proud of it. And one example, I don't know if you saw 2 years ago, the Olympic opening ceremony, the Olympic Games opening ceremony, which is a big like dance and singing and a big festival, which was watched by, I think it was 400 million people, something like that. And the National Health Service was in the centre of it, yeah, because that's how important it is to people. Housing, lots of new houses being built. Education. The education system was completely changed. In some ways, in this way, they established the basic characteristics of the British education system even today. Firstly, a lot of control is local. That is to say that in Manchester, there is an education council which decides many things for education in Manchester. Whereas, as you know, in France, everything, the whole decisions is centralised. So there's a tradition of local control. And secondly, they introduced an idea of why did it do that? An idea of a tripart education system. The general ideology at the time was most people thought, and certainly the experts thought, that people are naturally more intelligent or less intelligent. This was the general idea. And so they decided that at 11 years old, they would pass an exam. Everybody would pass an exam at 11 years old called the 11 plus exam. I passed this exam in 1971. There you go, now you know how terribly old I am. After the exam, they would divide the pupils into three different kinds of schools. Donc on n'a pas le collège unique. Il faut dire que le collège unique en France, c'est plus tard aussi, hein, c'est les années 60, je crois. So after you have taken the exam at 11 years old, you can go to grammar schools. About 25% of people, I think, went to grammar schools. If you go to grammar school, you will learn Latin. And generally intellectual subjects, you know, maths, English literature, not philosophy, and certainly philosophy is not in there, science, etc. And you might go to university. You have a chance of going, not definitely. At this time, not many people go to university, but you have a chance of going to university. Most people, I think it was about 70%, went to secondary schools. In fact, we called them secondary modern schools, where you would learn less intellectual subjects. The boys would do woodwork. They would also do English and maths, okay? But then the boys would do woodwork and metalwork. The girls would do domestic science, yeah, cooking. This happened quite late in the 1970s. My sisters did cooking at school, and I didn't do cooking at school, which is quite funny because one of my sisters can't cook and I'm a very good cook, so it obviously didn't work. So obviously today, even in Britain, it would be impossible to say, okay, now the girls are doing cooking and the boys are doing woodwork. Yeah, this is no longer acceptable. Fortunately, I think. This is the division. Now, the theory was, or the claim was, we have the same respect for everybody, but some people are more intellectual than others. This was the official explanation. In reality, as you can imagine, there was more money for grammar schools, not so much money for secondary models, etc., as you can imagine. And also, this was very much based on the idea of the 11 plus exam. That is to say, when you're 11, it's already possible. Oh yes, you should go to university, you shouldn't. That's old enough. That was the idea, which is generally not accepted today. Now, the 11 plus was an IQ test. And seeing that if you passed it, if you were successful, you had a good chance of going to university, and here you are in university, Fortunately, I can remember one of the questions from my 11 plus exam, and so we will see if you deserve to be in university or if really I should throw you out. And so here is your question. Don't answer it. Just put your hand up if you are sure, but don't say the answer. Okay. And the question is, what was the biggest island in the Pacific Ocean before Australia was discovered? And so don't answer, just raise your hand. If you're sure you know the answer, raise your hand. Oh dear, I think none of you should be in university. Shall I help you a little bit? It's not a geography exam. It's an intelligence exam. Yeah, you got an idea?
I think it's still Australia.
Absolutely correct. Australia. Before Australia was discovered, Australia was still in the Pacific Ocean. So I'm afraid we have only one person who deserves to be in university. Now, of course, I'm joking. And it's true that today, IQ tests, les tests de QI, people don't believe in them anymore. They're a game. They're amusing games, but they're not respected by experts anymore. It was a very strange way of doing things. I was at school, and when you were 10 years old, the teachers said, okay, there are 30 people in this class. For 3 hours every week, 10 people, you will go and do special training for this exam because we think you are the people who should pass it. This is exactly what happened to me. Yeah? So it's obviously not very fair. It was not fair at all, really. Yeah. So I went to a grammar school and went to university, and here I am. Okay, right. So what else did we do? Let's go back to the structure then, and let me tell you a little bit more about these people. Clement Attlee, Prime Minister, Christian Socialist. Yeah, Clement Attlee was a Christian Socialist. Left-wing gentleman. He worked. Yes. I didn't describe the technical schools. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, the technical schools were supposed to be the bottom of people who were really just going to very, very soon leave school and become apprentices in low-prestige jobs. Now, the reason I forgot them is that fairly quickly the technical schools disappeared, and there was only grammar and secondary modern. And this system continues until the 1960s. So not so long, 20 years. It continues for 20 years. Because just like in France, the Collège Unique, in fact, was not only because people wanted it to be fair, it was also because the economy and industry was changing so quickly that the old system was not giving the economy what they needed. Sorry, thank you for reminding me. So Christian, Clement Attlee, he used to work in a boys' club in the poor parts of town. He was not poor, but he worked in a poor part of town and became very interested in changing society for poor people. He became the mayor of Stepney, which is a very poor place, part of London. He became the mayor of Stepney in 1919, and he was elected Member of Parliament in 1922. And he never imagined he would be Prime Minister, of course. Ernest Bevin, the second guy, you mustn't get confused between Bevin and Bevan. Yeah? Okay. Ernest Bevin was a trade unionist. He was the secretary of a very big trade union, the Transport and General Workers Union. And he came from a poor family. His parents died when he was young. He became a not very radical trade union leader. For example, in the 1926 general strike, he wanted to end the strike as soon as possible. Bevin was a very much an anti-communist, not at all sympathetic to communists, and he became the foreign secretary. He played an important role in getting Britain to join NATO. L'OTAN était créé dans ces années-là, et on pourrait penser qu'un gouvernement très à gauche ne voudrait pas le rejoindre. But in fact, they did join it because of that. And finally, Anoira Bevan, I already mentioned him. He was a minor originally. His father was a Baptist and his mother was a Methodist. This is important. These are small religions with a tradition of oratory, a tradition of a little bit like Martin Luther King, you know, I have a dream. And Anoira Bevan, when he spoke, was very much like that. You know, he was a bit of a rabble rouser. He had a very bad time at school. He had very bad marks at school. And during the 30s, he worked for the Committee for the Relief of the Victims of German Fascism. So he wanted the British to do more to welcome the Jewish people fleeing from Germany. In fact, the British government was not very interested in Jews fleeing from. And also, Anoira Bevan was active in supporting the Spanish Republicans in the Spanish Civil War against General Franco. And he said Britain should send arms. Britain should send arms to support the Democrats against the fascists. Of course, this did not happen. So Anoira Bevan then became Minister of Health and was tremendously popular. One of the reasons that I can see here that quite a lot of people wear glasses. I have my glasses in there. Now, in the 1940s, most people who needed glasses could not afford to buy them. And in 1945, glasses were free. And you can imagine, that's quite hard not to have glasses if you need glasses. It's quite a big thing, yeah? And so this was one of the big things. The other thing was dental treatments. People had very bad teeth. And older people, they couldn't afford to go to the dentist. Even to get false teeth, they couldn't afford them. And so this was free in 1945. So this really transformed people's lives. And I have here a little letter that was sent to Anoira Bevan, an old lady who sent him a letter saying thank you for the free teeth treatment, because for 10 years I have not been out of the house because I'm too ashamed. So really big transformations in people's lives. I think it's important to remember that and not just see the statistics. Of course, the statistics are very good. I think it was very, very important changes in people's lives. Okay, post-war consensus, post-war settlement. Now, this is simply to look at the fact that... Yes?
Bevin,
Ernest Bevin. He was a rather conservative trade union leader, and he was the man who had wanted the 1926 general strike to be as short as possible. He's not a radical guy. Now, one of the most important elements of the welfare state is that the Labour Party established in 1945 the welfare state. And 6 years later, the Conservative Party won the elections. 1951, the Conservative Party won the elections. And many people imagined that they would abolish the welfare state. In 1945, Winston Churchill had campaigned more or less against the welfare state. He gave... if I remember correctly, Winston Churchill said, here are our five priorities. One, two, three, four, five. And number five was housing. But the problem he had was, for the population, number one was housing. Yeah. And so he wasn't there. So everybody imagined that perhaps the Conservatives would reverse the welfare state. But in fact, it was politically impossible. The problem is that you can have a country where people have to pay for doctors, and they will accept it approximately because, you know, it's always been that way. But if you make doctors free, then 5 years later it is impossible to say, oh, they're not free anymore. It becomes politically impossible. Nobody will vote for you. So when the Conservative Party carried out the election campaign in 1951, they did not say, we will reverse free health. We will not at all, not at all. And so, in fact, for at least 20 years, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, they had differences, but they both accepted the welfare state. And this has led some people to talk about a post-war consensus. Does this mean there was a consensus between Labour and Conservative? For example, the Labour Party built many new houses. Every year, 200,000, 300,000 new houses every year. The Conservative Party continued building 200 or 300,000 new houses every year. So it wasn't... and so people have said, is this a consensus? And today, most historians prefer the words post-war settlements. Because it's not that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party agree. It's that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party both accept that it is now politically obligatory. So it's about what people were prepared to accept. So as I say, in 1945, Winston Churchill and the Conservatives campaigned against the National Health Service. But in 51, the situation has changed. We want to be elected. It's still a democratic country. Remember, in a democratic country, the Prime Minister can't do anything they want because they will never get elected again. They could do some things they want and work very hard at working it. This is why, for example, we will see later on that Margaret Thatcher wanted very much to reduce the welfare state, but she never said, you must pay when you go to the doctor. Because in Britain, you must pay when you go to the doctor is political suicide. It's political suicide. Un peu en France, un politicien de droite ne peut pas dire l'année prochaine, il y aura les frais d'inscription à l'université, c'est 10 000 euros par an. En Angleterre, c'est 10 000 euros par an aujourd'hui, hein? Donc c'est faisable. Mais vous imaginez, un politicien conservateur, il dit ça, vous êtes d'accord avec moi, hein? C'est du suicide. Il a quoi? Il a 1 million de jeunes dans la rue dans la semaine. Alors, peut-être dans 20 ans, ils réussiront, hein? C'est pas impossible. Mais tout de suite, il y a des choses qu'on ne fait pas, même si on pense que c'est une bonne idée, on ne le fait pas parce que... It's a democratic country. Now, a democratic country doesn't mean that the people control everything, but it means that the people have some influence there. Okay, so that was what happened. 1945, Clement Attlee won, but I'm now going to move on then to the next government, and the Conservatives will be in power from 1951 to 1964. So, this is rather strange in a way, because, you know, the golden age of the Labour Party only lasts for 6 years. It's not very, I know 6 years is a long time if you're waiting for a bus, but in history, 6 years is not a long time. However, they instituted the welfare state, which the Conservatives were obliged to respect. And we had, in this period then, a number of prime ministers. Who was prime minister? Well, we got Winston Churchill again in 1951. In 1955, these are all Conservative prime ministers. Anthony Eden. And in 1957, Harold Macmillan. So these are the three Conservative prime ministers. As I say, prime ministers don't decide everything. But nevertheless, you need to know the prime ministers and their dates because that allows you to give the main thing. But I'm not quite there yet, actually, because I think I'll leave that because you're going to see a documentary about that. So let's leave that and go for. I'm confusing my structure a little bit here. Right. Oh, I'm going to say a few more things about the 1945 government first. Of course, the difficulty in 1945 was that Britain had no money. Huh? The the war was extremely expensive, as you can imagine. Extremely expensive. And suddenly, the United States ended their policy of lend-lease. This is, so I'm going to talk about the Marshall Plan. During the war, the American government had voted a very generous loan scheme for lending money to Britain, Lend-Lease, and suddenly, in 1945, they said, okay, it's finished now. And Britain was in a desperate position. They had no money at all. And really, what was going to happen is that the United States of America was going to remind Britain that Britain was no longer the most powerful country in the world. And so Britain was, we need money, we need you to lend us some money. And the United States, we have some conditions. And the conditions, the most important condition was the end of imperial preference. And I will explain that to you in a moment. The end of that is to say, before 1945, Britain still had an impressive system with the Commonwealth and the rest of the empire to have privileged trade relations. So, for example, the British colonies were not allowed to choose who they commerced with. They were obliged to prefer Britain. There is a reason for having colonies. It makes you money. Yeah? And so Britain had this imperial preference system. So, for example, Kenya or any other, Rhodesia, South Africa, they were obliged to give first choice to Britain in trade. And the United States said, we will lend you money if you eliminate this rule. And of course, this meant, because the United States was the biggest economy, if the colonies of Britain were open to competition, a lot of the trade would go to America. And so the power of money won over the power of imperial tradition, which was in Britain. And in fact, in some people said, this looks like the economic conditions of defeat, not the economic conditions of victory. And I think I mentioned to you last week that this loan, the last payment was made in 2006. Le dernier paiement de ce prêt américain a été fait en 2006. Okay? So quite a long thing. Okay, so now I really am going to move on to the Conservative government. 1950 elections. The Labour Party won the elections in 1950, but lost the elections in 1951. In 1951, there was also something of a crisis for the Labour Party, because Aneurin Bevan, the founder of the NHS, resigned as minister. Why did he resign? Because the government introduced a charge. He says, okay, the government had a new idea. The government said, okay, health in general is free, but if you want false teeth, you must pay half the price. And this was too much for Aneurin Bevan. He said, no, free is a point of principle. And so he resigned. Now, for the question which I mentioned on the plan there, culture, number 9, culture. Just want to mention a few of the important writers at this time. Certainly George Orwell is one of the most important ones. Now, he's very famous for two books, 1984 and Animal Farm, but these are probably not his best books or his most interesting books. Now, does anybody know any more of his books? No, that's Aldous Huxley. Yeah. Yep, that's right. That's the one I just mentioned. Yeah. No, nobody knows anymore. Okay. Now, George Orwell is a very interesting gentleman because he wrote throughout the 30s and 40s a series of books which are still very well reading, well worth reading. First of all, he established tradition of journalism which still exists today with his 1933 book Down and Out in Paris and London. Ça a été traduit dans la dèche à Paris et à Londres. And what he did is he went and lived in Paris and in London as a homeless person, sleeping wherever he could, pretending to be completely poor, and recording what life was like for very poor people. Now, this tradition continues today. Vous avez peut-être vu les livres de Anne Tristan récemment, où elle a fait semblant d'être un immigré clandestine en France, hein, pour écrire comment c'était la vie pour ces gens. J'ai oublié le titre de son livre. So he was one of the person who established this idea of je pense que je me confonds. Anne Tristan, c'est celle qui a fait semblant d'être une militante du Front National. Pour avoir, elle n'était pas, pour avoir les infos. Et il y a une autre récemment, très célèbre, celle qui était otage pendant un an. Elle n'a pas fait exprès ça, là. Florence Aubenas, qui a fait semblant d'être une immigrée clandestine pour écrire un livre dessus, voilà. He also wrote some books like this one, Burmese Days, which is about when he was a policeman in the Empire. So he was a metropolitan, an Englishman, who was sent as a policeman to Burma under the Empire, and Burmese Days is a denunciation of colonialism, but in great detail of the attitudes of white people out there. And he also wrote The Road to Wigan Pier. All of these books are excellent. 1937, which was about working class people in Britain. Again, that is journalism. For his novels, he wrote a denunciation of capitalism. Really, in this novel, Keep the Estradista Flying. And this is a book about the lower middle class, the people who have no money but think they are a little superior. We all know people like this. Very probably his best book. And finally then, Homage to Catalonia. This is not a novel, this is what happened when he went to Spain. Because he went to Spain to fight in the army against the fascists, and Homage to Catalonia is his account of the Spanish Revolution. And of course the most famous ones then, 1945, Animal Farm. Which is an allegory, where he talks about the Russian Revolution and the rise of Stalinism, but it all happens in a farm, and the pig is Stalin, and the result is a terrible dictatorship. This was an interesting book to write in 1945 because a lot of the left in Europe had a very positive view of Stalin. Now, this was not only because they were sometimes rather foolish. It was also that it was Russia who won the Second World War. In reality, the British and the Americans and the French did a bit, and the Russians, I think they lost 15 million people or something incredible. And the Russians, the Second World War was a war between Germany and Russia, where the other countries did a little bit, enormous. And so the prestige of Russia in 1945 was enormous in the whole of Europe. They thought, well, you know, Russia is really the people who defeated the Nazis. And so there was a big tendency to idealize Stalin and to not see the dictatorship. Yeah, that was very, very common. And so George Orwell lost a lot of friends by writing Animal Farm, where he denounces Stalinism. And 1948, 1984, Yes, so how did George Orwell find the title for his book? Le Sable Inversé. And I think that's very important to remember, because I think 1984 is a well-known book and film, but people forget when it was written, and it was written at this time. And pretty interesting stuff. Who were the other important writers at this time in Britain? C.S. Lewis. Now, a few years ago, I used to mention C.S. Lewis in my classes, and nobody had heard of him. But now they have made films of the Narnia books, which are, I personally think, are much more solid than Harry Potter. Well, that's my personal thing. C.S. Lewis, a conservative gentleman, very intelligent conservative gentleman, Catholic. Remember that Catholics are a minority in Britain. Only 10% of British are Catholic. I'm a Catholic, but we're in a minority. And he wrote books of kind of philosophy. Very, very, very good books. I do recommend these. The Screwtape Letters in 1942. And the Screwtape Letters are a story of the devil. As you know, in Christian and especially Catholic ideology, you have God on one side, he's a goody, and the devil on the other side, he's baddie. Okay, just to clarify. And the Screwtape Letters are letters written by a servant of the devil to the devil, explaining how I manage to persuade human beings to sin. How does jealousy work? This is how I make people jealous, etc. And although they are religious books, in fact, the psychology is very interesting, very detailed ones there. 1943, Voyage to Venus. So this is, of course, Voyage to Venus. Today, that's not so surprising, but remember, this is before space travel, and so science fiction books are much more amazing and much more impressive. This is a time when American science fiction is on the rise. Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, the great writers of science fiction, and C.S. Lewis was in there. And then, of course, the Narnia series, which are seven books, of which my favourite one is The Silver Chair. There you go, now you know. This is also, of course, the period when Tolkien is writing. The Lord of the Rings, he begins writing it during the Second World War. And in fact, he writes it as letters to his son. His son is in the army, and he writes like 20 pages and sends it to his son in the army. And it's a very interesting book, actually, because he didn't want to publish it. It was something he wrote for his son. He thought, you know, who will want to read this? But in fact, as you know, it's become very successful, first as a book and then as a film. I have read it 17 times. There you go, now you know. Right, okay, so what else do we have here in the at the end of the 1940s? So I think this is number 10. Yeah, culture was number 9. And so it's 10. We have the beginnings of decolonization. The beginnings of decolonization. India. I stop there now. I mentioned, the question of money and the fact that the British needed American money. Ah, j'avais oublié quand j'avais posé la question, est-ce que je parle trop vite? En fait, je veux dire trop vite pour comprendre, pas trop vite pour prendre des notes. Parce que si vous prenez c'est parce que vous prenez mal les notes. Mais si c'est trop vite pour comprendre, je veux bien ralentir. Okay, decolonization. So the question of money reminded us that America is now the boss.
Yeah, okay.
There's no doubt about it. America is now the boss. It's complicated, but when necessary, the Americans can tell where they're still the boss. And of course, Britain used to be the boss. The biggest empire in history. The list is so long. Nobody can memorize the list of the British colonies. You know, from Singapore, India, Kenya. I think there are 250. Yeah? It's absolutely enormous. But the biggest was India. India was known as the jewel in the crown. This was the slogan, the jewel in the crown, not in the corona, but in the crown. A very strange relationship, really, because Britain is a small country with, at this time, maybe 40 million people, and India had 200 million. So how did they do that? Yeah, a very, very strange thing. I can't go back to the entire history of the British Empire in India, but as one writer said, if the history of British rule were to be condensed into a single fact, it is this: there was no increase in India per capita income between 1757 and 1947. That is to say, 1757, 1947. Between these two dates, the average Indian was the same level standard of living. They did not get any richer for 200 years under British rule. Now, that's not a very positive thing to say about British rule. This is a period when famine disappeared in Europe. In the whole of Europe, everybody's lives got better between 1757 and 1947. Yeah, the end of famine, the beginning of housing, the beginning of health services, etc. And in India, no improvement. So certainly that's a very negative fact about the British thing. So quite understandably, the Indians began to want independence. Not all of them. There was always a division. There's always people who don't want it. And the big steps in this, some of them you looked at perhaps last year, was 1857. In 1857, there was a big rebellion in Britain. They call this the Indian Mutiny because it began with the mutineering of a group of soldiers. In India, they call it the First War of Independence. So it's the same events, but you can look at it from a different point of view. It was enormous. The British elite were very shocked. They imagined that the Indians were happy to be a colony. They really believed that. So they were very shocked. The repression of the Indian Mutiny was tremendously violent. One of the horrible facts about it is, I can't give you all the story, one of the horrible facts about it is that one of the religions in India, I can't remember which one, says that the dead body, must remain intact, because when you are going to live again, in their religion, your body will be used again. And so when they executed the mutineers, they strapped them to a cannon and fired a cannonball through the body, so that they would be killed and religiously destroyed. That's just one fact, but this is repression. This is an average way which empires deal with rebellions against the empire. It's nothing very special, but it's not, you know, it makes you kind of happy that the empires are kind of finishing. And in any case, as usual with rebellions, the British government did two things. First of all, repression, and then concessions. Because and so they allowed an Indian middle class to become lawyers, to have a little bit of power locally. And of course, the problem from an imperialist point of view of giving people a little bit of power is that they want more. And this led to a big campaign for independence. And of course, the most famous gentleman in this is Gandhi. To go quickly into the 20th century, in the 1920s and the 1930s, Gandhi organized a series of non-violence campaigns for independence, massively followed and massively impressive. For example, in 1930, they had a campaign against the salt tax. When you bought salt in India, you had to pay a big tax to Britain. In hot countries, salt is very important. You must have salt. And it was, of course, there's a lot of sea around India, and you can make salt from the sea, but it's illegal. It was illegal. And so Gandhi organized a big march to the sea, thousands of people who marched to the sea, and made salts. And they were arrested by the police. But of course, this was the front page of every newspaper in the world. The Indians make salt from the sea, the British policemen arrested them. Yeah? So this is a very intelligent politician. Gandhi wanted the British Empire to be humiliated in every newspaper in the world, and it was successful. In any case, the situation continued, and at the end of the Second World War, the British realised that it's needed to change, that it needed to accept Indian independence. And they appointed a new viceroy, because the king or the queen was, well, the king at this time, was represented in India by a viceroy, and the new viceroy was Lord Mountbatten. Lord Mountbatten was considered to be a very radical viceroy, but it wasn't very difficult to be a radical viceroy. That is to say, he sometimes invited Indian people to dinner. Yeah. The viceroys had never even talk to the Indians. You know, they just had their little white community. You know, it was a tremendously racist situation. And they decided then allow India to become independent, and they decided to accept, for reasons I can't go into, a division between India and Pakistan. Pakistan as a Muslim country and India as a Hindu country. This was done in a very bizarre way, because the problem was to draw the line, because it was not a historical line. They drew the line. Lord Mountbatten drew the line. And he kept the line secret. And so you have this, because they didn't want a lot of violence immediately. And so you have this really bizarre situation where Lord Mountbatten went to the celebrations in Pakistan, celebrations for independence, and the next day he went to India, celebrations for independence, and he was the only man who knew where the border was. He went back to England and then published the border, and there was tremendous outbreaks of violence in India, especially on the border. In some towns the Hindus killed the Muslims, and in other towns the Muslims killed the Hindus. It was a terrible, terrible thing. The exact explanation is quite complicated, but certainly the British had always encouraged a division between the Muslims and the Hindus, because when you're the boss, it's good to divide and rule. And so that was, however, the end then of British rule in India, and the beginning of the end for the British Empire. Everybody hoped, among the British elite, they hoped the rest of the empire would stay. But really, once they lost India, the biggest, it was the beginning of the end. And this is why, when Churchill said in 1945, if the British Empire lasts 1,000 years, people will still say this was their finest hour. In fact, he was dreaming 1,000 years, 20 years maybe. And that's the beginning of the end.